Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today, Ellen Brown. Oh, we've got a lot to talk about with Ellen. Ellen, of course, wrote the book Web of Death. Can't have Ellen on the program without mentioning Web of Debt, and it really ties in with a topic maybe we can kick the program off on, but Ellen's book really goes in depth into the horrors of the private banking system and how it usurped money creation power, and most important, how we can get it back. And Ellen also heads the Public Banking Institute. It's an initiative to get it back, to put money power back in the hands of the people where it belongs. And in late April, Ellen had her inaugural convention on public banking in Philadelphia. I told Ellen I'm not certain the city of brotherly love will ever be the same again. And I say that in the good sense of the word. Ellen, welcome. I do want to talk about the conference. It's the first time I've had a chance. We've exchanged some emails on it, but it's the first time I've had a chance to discuss it on air, and I think it's important to do it. And your newest article, you're back on the student loan racket, and a good day to include that in the discussion. And Russia Today has had a feature story today on it, and all the people, well, you know, giving examples of people literally whose lives are ruined by this loan shark law that literally entraps people in debt, students in debt, and you cannot get, well, we can get into it, you can't get out of it. You know, it's like the Roche Motel. They go in, but they don't come out. You know, you can come out if you, well, you know, you pay your bill. Roaches don't pay bills anyway. Talk about the conference, Ellen.
Oh, it was exceeded expectations. It was a great success. We are really pleased with it. This is my 20th conference on money reform since I, you know, wrote Web of Debt in 2007. And to me, it was the best conference I've ever been to. I didn't see anybody looking bored. Everybody was raptly paying attention during the whole thing. We had some really great speakers. The star was a little 12-year-old Victoria Grant.
12 years old.
She's 12 years old, and she's from Canada. And she did this. She talked about the Bank of Canada and how at one time Canada had borrowed from its own bank and was essentially not quite debt free, but the debt was very low and manageable. And then it shot up, and so she started out, why are we in debt, and why don't we just issue our own money or borrow from our own bank? So it's basic, you know, Canadian money reform stuff, but she was so good. She says she wrote it, and she certainly seems to have understood everything she was saying. She's on video. In fact, her video is up on Max Kaiser right now, her video from our banking institution. Institute. That's the first one we got up. The one problem we have, you know, we have no funding. We're totally volunteers. We're all volunteers. So we're a little slow at sort of technical things like getting videos up. And but for being volunteers, I mean, it looked great. That the artwork was great. We had some really excellent professional volunteers who did all that.
Oh, I think it's absolutely marvelous. I told you that in my working lifetime in a small family business, we put on conventions all the time. We began working in the 1960s, putting on career fairs for exiting junior military officers back in the Vietnam era. And, of course, times changed, so business models changed. And we shifted from veterans. There always were some who showed up. Not Vietnam was long over with 1975, but the numbers dwindled just to a handful here or there. But we began working with professionals, and we made good client contacts, and we kept a good many of them and made new friends along the way. And we put these events on around the country and in hotels. Nearly always they were in hotels. And I mentioned in one email to you that when you put on enough of these conferences, you can tell some wonderful stories about some glorious events, and you can tell some horror ones about the kind of things that go on. You know, the law of averages don't work for you all the time. I don't want to go into that. That's a different topic altogether. But, of course, this was awfully
major,
important.
Oh, it was a major production for us. It was our first one. I was in total panic when it was first set for... We have a 5-member board, and we meet every week diligently. And it seems like they're my best friends, even though one of them I hadn't even met until the conference in person. And so we had a committee that was doing that, working on the conference, and they had decided it would be in Philadelphia, and they had done all this work. So it was all set, and I said, so where are the people going to stay? And nobody had really thought about that. And so we looked into lodging, and there was absolutely no place for people to stay. So my panic button went off, and Ann and I scurried around and found 3 hotels that looked suitable, that were reasonable, and we listed those on the website. And within a week, they were full. There was no place. They weren't even available. So then Mark, the executive director, found a place in New Jersey, and we got a bus that went to New Jersey, and you know, we got a special rate over there. But so it worked out. But you know, it was like all these things that the next year will definitely be much more efficient.
I still remember my first one. Well, it went pretty. It was small compared to later ones. Very, very small. It was almost like a coming out party, a microcosm of what the later ones became. But the first one, my great memory from the first one was, it was absolutely exhausting. You know, I mean, we were feeling our way through when you're treading on pathways that you've never ventured on before. You don't know quite what's up ahead, and you feel your way through. But I remember, and I was certainly a lot younger than I am now, we went through a weekend, a Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday, and at the end of it, I was absolutely exhausted. I was delighted that I thought things went okay, but it wore me out. And I remember thinking at the time, Ellen, if we have to keep doing this stuff, I don't know how long I'm going to last. I had no idea this would be our core operation, but you know, you get other people involved and they help. We all pitch in, and once you get the routine down, it goes a lot more smoothly.
Mm-hmm. I didn't get enough sleep for the whole thing or for a period of time before that. But you know, I wasn't tired. It was strange. It's like you're sort of high on adrenaline. I mean, I was real tired the day after when you get that adrenaline collapse, but yeah, it was great.
Oh, indeed, I understand that. When you're going through one of these, they go well into the evening, and I did then what I never would do now: eat dinner. I never wanted to eat dinner before a program. I wanted to be lean and mean going into it. So I would always wait until the program was over, and then a few of us would go out. Sometimes we'd take a company client out with us, and we ate dinner at a god-awful hour. I mean, my stomach would be inside out if I tried doing that stuff now, besides the things I ate in those days that I never would eat now. But midnight dinners and I absolutely would not get along very well today. But we did that stuff routinely back then. I nearly had Ronald Reagan come to one of my California programs, believe it or not, when he was governor of California.
I had
him scheduled to come. And then some conflict came up. Oh, good Lord, I've never to this day forgiven him for that.
Yeah.
Well, I got the mayor of San Diego in his place. But we went out to dinner with him. Oh, that's another story I can skip. He was nothing. I'm sure he's in his grave right now, so I can talk about him, and I won't mention his name. it was a laughable experience. But anyway.
I'll just say about ours. The good thing was it was all about solutions, and we had different people with different solutions. You know, we didn't necessarily all agree on everything, but it was just so interesting. It was all very forward-looking, not... it wasn't just a lot of ranting about what's wrong, but it was about what we can do about it and how we can get out of this and how we got sucked into it by fraud or by, you know, ignorance or whatever. Anyway, that if we just straighten out our understanding of money and who should issue it, we can fix the thing.
Well, I make no bones about it, Ellen. To me, the core problem that has to be fixed is money, power in private hands, and they use it to make more of it for themselves. And the ordinary people of the country are the ones who suffer the most because of this. And the tables could be turned if money power went back to private hands where it belongs. There are lots of possibilities that I don't see likely at best today. You know, I mean, enough public pressure can get things done that never would be without that pressure. But with money power in the hands of the people who manipulate it for their own benefit, without changing that, I simply don't see great change happening in the country, and it bothers me that the Occupy Wall Street people don't get it. They don't talk about that.
They're not really focused on that. I agree, but there are rumblings. I mean, they post my articles and so forth. it seems to me though that it's becoming more and more obvious who the bad guy is. At least, I mean, at least Wall Street pointed the finger. Occupy Wall Street pointed the finger in the right direction. It's so clear now that we're in being exploited, and we're in an extractive society. I mean, our economy. I was just reading something about China, and the theory was that the Chinese were doing so well because their upper class was extracting from the poor. But that's not actually true. The poor have come up faster and farther than anyone ever in history. And so that it really is a case of a rising tide floats all boats, or lifts all boats. Whereas here, the rich are so obviously getting richer, and the poor are just, we just went to a function last night. It was Max Kaiser's here in town, and so we went to listen to him. And a bunch of my old friends came out of the woodwork. There were tons of people there that I knew from. And I was just, there's several of my friends, these are my good friends, actually live in their cars, and one of them is a woman. I couldn't believe, she was one of my best friends, and she sort of disappeared from the scene. Apparently she's embarrassed to be living in her car, and she's been living in her car for 2 years. Can you believe that? A woman. And my good friend, very smart. I mean, we're not talking about the dregs, this is, you know, people that can't pull it off otherwise. These are people that used to... The men had their, one was a book, had its own bookstore, one had his, one was an engineer, one was, had his own business, and the woman had her own business. I assume she still does. She's a health practitioner. So it's alarming. And then, we actually have a depression just like the 1930s depression, except you just don't see it as much. They're living in their cars instead of sleeping in the parks. They're not allowed to sleep in the parks anymore. The bread lines are at Walmart at midnight instead of out in the streets where you see them. It's the mothers lining up to get milk at midnight on January or on the first of the month when their food stamps kick in.
Ellen, that's absolutely right. I say over and over again when I write articles relating to the economy that we are going through a mainstream depression. I guess a big difference between now and the 1930s is you've got this god-awful wealth disparity between rich people and everybody else, and how the middle class is being harmed so badly now. In the 1930s, the rich folks, you know, I mean, there were some, I don't know how many jumped out of windows. I mean, there were some who lost fortunes in the Wall Street crash and maybe went through some tough times, and I'm sure there were some who maybe lost everything. But in general, the rich folks didn't have the wolf at their door, and ordinary people were harmed terribly, but there were policies in place to get people back to work. There just weren't enough of them or enough money spent. But now everything is exactly the opposite. There haven't been jobs created. Wealth is at unprecedented levels. It keeps growing. The gap between rich and everybody else keeps growing. We have a bipartisan complicity behind this policy. Doesn't matter whether it's Obama or Bush or Romney. They are together on this. And people wonder, people say, I've had a debate with one of my relatives who says, well, you know, I mean, Obama, I've got nothing good to say about him, but, you know, compared to Romney, what other choice have we got? And I try to drum home the important fact is that, you know, there are some issues where Obama is different than Romney. He just came out for gay marriage. Well, he didn't give a damn. He didn't do it because he cares about gay people wanting to get married. He frankly doesn't give a damn. He did it for political reasons. So understand what he's doing in an election year. A year from today, I don't think he would have done it. Or if he, let's say he would have. Or for stem cell research. Those things are important. But they don't rise to the level of corporate theft, corporate dominance, a war and peace, persecution of innocent people at home, you know, police state terrorism, police state laws. Those are the biggest issues that we have to deal with. And the others are important, but they're less important than the biggest ones. When it comes to the biggest issues of all, Republicans and Democrats are in lockstep, absolutely identical. They are identical twins on this. The rhetoric differs, Ellen. You'll hear Obama say different things about the economy than Romney, but you know, when they get in their back rooms and they cut their deals, and there already is a deal cut post-election, and the deal is minimally $4 trillion from domestic spending out of the economy, out of the budget, you know, budget cutting on the backs of people who can't afford it. At the same time, the wars will go on, military spending will increase, corporate taxes will be cut. Obama, Romney, could be Mickey Mouse. These are the policies that they favor, and ordinary people are hurt so much. Want to segue a little bit into the student loan racket again, because you just wrote about it.
Yeah, well, what I wrote about was that seniors are being hit up on their Social Security for student loans. And these aren't necessarily new ones. I mean, the problem is student debt is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. It doesn't go away. The statute of limitations don't apply. You know, normally, if somebody doesn't collect on a contract, a written contract, it's four years, and then it goes away. But your student debt, it could be 20 years ago. Or 30 years ago, and they can still collect on it. And of course, they're coming back and collecting on everything in sight just to get the money. But the problem is, that this could, when you incurred it, well, I cited one case where when she incurred it, it was $3,500, like 10 years ago. It wasn't that long ago when she went to school to try to better herself in her 50s, thinking that if she had a degree that would get her a better job. And of course, by the time she got out, she was unemployable. She couldn't get a job. I mean, the whole economy had taken a downturn, and they didn't want people in there that are just starting out in their 50s. And so she didn't have anything to pay it back with. But the debt 10 years later was $17,000 to $20,000. I mean, how did it go up so much by a factor of more than, at least five, it looks like? Because it went up so much because of interest. They have no regulation on student debt at all. You can charge any interest rate you want. Well, I mean, in other words, the usury laws have been lifted. We know if you set up your company so that you're in one of the states that doesn't have usury laws, then your company can just practice in any other state. So they have no. I've read of cases. I'm not sure what her interest rate was, but I've read of cases where the interest rate on these student debts has gone up to like 18% to 20%. Mm. So at 20%, your debt doubles in 3.5 years. So just the interest could kill you. But besides that, if you don't pay, if you default, then they can tack on all these fees, and they can raise the interest rate. And she says nobody ever contacted her. So she may have been in default, but nobody let her know that she was racking up all these fees. So anyway, and now they're taking her out of her Social Security. So, and there she's getting, she's got two grandkids to support plus herself, and she's getting $750 a month. They can't cut it below that. That's the rule. You can't, but they can take out 15% from Social Security. So that's, it may not sound like a lot, but that's 15% she can't afford, and that at the rate of paying off a $20,000 debt, that could take her the rest of her life.
Well, she may not even be able to do it for the rest of her life. And one of the dirty secrets is, the default rate is absolutely astronomical. And these vultures, the loan issuers and the other company, the collection agencies, they're in cahoots with each other. And they prefer to see people default because if they can't pay off the debt, they can keep charging these loan shock interest rates,
the
debt burden grows. It never goes away. It literally can stay with you for the rest of your life. I guess it can't follow you into the grave, but if you're married, maybe it follows your wife or your husband until he or she goes into the grave. At some point, it has to end, but I'm not quite certain where the end game is. I mean, the law hasn't been around that long that we have people, most people going to school, not elderly people going back to school, but most people going to school are younger people, like we were, Ellen, when we were in school. So, you know, you have a long lifetime ahead of you before you reach the end of it. And what happens to this debt that you've accumulated and it's still unpaid? Well, we never had those problems when we were back in school. Education was cheap. I never needed a loan in college. I took a tiny one in grad school that I easily repaid the first year. I don't remember what the interest on it was, but I think it was nothing. Interest rates in those days were low, so I'm sure the rates were very low. And today, Ellen, these people charge loan shock interest rates, and we're living in an age of near zero interest rates. If you're a bank and you can go to the Fed window, you can get near free money. You can call it free money, and then you can loan it out and get these high rates. Talk about a racket, Ellen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the reason that's even in the news right now is that interest rates are going to now go up to 6.8% on student loans because they had cut them temporarily in half to 3.4%. So both Obama and Romney are, you know, they're in favor of keeping the rate at 3.4%. So they'll both come out looking like heroes because they've done something for students by maintaining the status quo. But the status quo is killing the students. Nobody's talking about what used to be obvious, which is that tuition should be free. I mean, we used to have free tuition. I went to Berkeley for free. The tuition was free. And, of course, the rents were, I remember I paid $50 a month for my rent. And I thought that was high at the time.
$50 for your rent? I'm going to scratch my head and try to remember the rent that I paid for the first time. But I know for an apartment when I was single, it was under $100. I know that. I mean, it was absolutely dirt cheap. And it was a different world back then, Ellen. And, of course, inflation has been manipulated to go up over time. So all of the profiteers that they gained from that profit immensely. Going back to 1913 when the Fed was created, I've lost count, but I remember writing once or twice what a $1913 was worth today. And I think the last time I did, I said it's worth less than 5 cents. It may be worth 3 cents now or 2 cents. I mean, if I live long enough, it'll probably go down to near zero. In other words, inflation has literally erased the value of what a dollar was back then. And of course, in Web of Debt, you explain back in the colonial days when the colonies controlled their own money, they didn't have any inflation, and they didn't need an income tax to charge people to raise taxes. They had a system that worked marvelously, and they had prosperity. I don't know that it lifted all boats. I don't know what people did. It was a different economy back then. My God, we're talking about 1600s, 1700s. America was an agrarian economy back then. I don't think there was much of any industry. There was small business, you know, merchants, things like that. So it was a completely different world back then. But there was prosperity, yeah. and the things that plague the country now and harm people so much for a brief generation didn't exist. We could have that again today if money went back into public hands where it belongs.
Mm-hmm. We just have to reconceptualize what money is. Everybody thinks that, or we get the impression that banks are either lending their own money. I mean, they've got the money, and so we're stuck with whatever terms they give us. But they're not lending their own money. They're creating loans on their books, and then when somebody comes for the money, when they have to pay a check out, when the check goes out the door, they have to clear the check, so they balance it with incoming deposits. But they don't actually lend the deposits, because your deposit is always there. Whenever you put your money in, if you go later to get your money, they'll always give it to you. They never say they've lent it out to somebody else and that you can't have it. So they're double counting the money. They're just creating that money on their books. A public bank could be doing the same thing, and all the interest would be going back to the public. And that was the colonial system, that the interest was sufficient. Well, particularly in Pennsylvania, this was the best of those systems. In Philadelphia, that was one of the reasons we had our conference in Philadelphia, because it was really the birthplace of this, or it was the proving ground. It wasn't the first of the land banks, but it was the proving ground of a public banking system as a form of funding your government, instead of the other colonies were just issuing money, which was good. You know, it beat the alternative, which was when they didn't have any money and they had to borrow from England, borrow paper banknotes, which weren't really borrowing gold. It was supposedly backed by gold, but it really wasn't. So the alternative, which was very clever, was that they issued their own money, but it was publicly issued money. But the problem was that it tended to hyperinflate. And so, because they tended to print more than they taxed back, it was a lot easier to spend the stuff than to get the colonists to fork it over for taxes. Because they were paying, the governors were like foreign imports, you know, they weren't elected, they were British. They were appointed by the crown. So the people didn't feel any great allegiance for paying taxes. But in Pennsylvania, what they did was they printed the little paper money, and then they lent it out, and then it came back in principal and interest, and the interest was sufficient to fund the government. We could do that today. Our banks pay collect $725 billion in interest last year, they did collectively, and we paid $450 billion in interest on the federal debt. So if you add those two things together, if it was the whole banking system were public, so that the interest came back to the public, that exceeds $1.1 trillion, which is what we paid in income taxes. So we could eliminate income taxes just by making interest a public, or making credit a public utility with the interest going back to the public.
Boy, we could literally change the world by doing that. And, you know, the system after the Bank of England took money power back, when we were doing well and England was going through some hard times, as I remember, you wrote about Benjamin Franklin going over and being queried in England, you know, how come you guys are doing well and we're suffering over here? And I guess he explained it. Well, England didn't want Americans to do well while they were going through hard times. Anyway, I mean, they wanted money power back. They wanted they wanted complete control. I do believe that the crown again regaining money power and benefiting at the expense of people in the colonies was the real factor behind the American Revolution. But of course, it was the elites of America against the elites of Britain. And after the so-called revolution, really not much changed except a change in management. I mean, the system for ordinary people didn't really mm-hmm. change that much. There just was a change of management. But that's another story, too. But It's comparable in a way to what's going on in Europe in the Eurozone today, Ellen, where you've got these countries, 17 dissimilar countries under common Euro straitjacket rules. So you have an economic juggernaut Germany, which might be the equivalent of the of England and Bank of England back in the colonial days, and you've got these pygmies like Greece and the big boys are just eating Greece's lunch, so that Greece is literally turned into a zombie state, and the people are going through extremely hard times. Well, they ought to learn a little American history, even if the wrong people ran the revolution, Ellen. They should realize that they've got to get out from under this system and do it any way you have to do it. Do it simply by saying goodbye, and if that doesn't work, have a revolution. Throw the bums out. I mean, they have enough problems on their hands. I don't know that they want to send in the Marines to keep you in the system. I think their solution is take the pain now, get out of their straitjacket, take whatever pain is necessary, get control of your own country again and your own money, and start remaking it. Argentina did that back around 2000, and they suffered for a while.
Yeah.
But they sure came out of it smelling like a rose.
Right.
Well, every one of the straitjacketed European countries can do the same thing. The ones that are suffering most are the ones that ought to consider doing it. Not just Greece, Ireland, Spain, Italy, even the big ones. It's only going to get worse for them. Hey, you know, just walk. Well, they could walk away. They don't need a revolution. But if that didn't work, have a revolution. And absolutely throw the unelected bums out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we can pick up on this when we come back, Ellen. I do get wound up. We'll be right back. On with Ellen Brown, author of Web of Debt, president of the Public Banking Institute, and an absolutely extraordinary writer on all things economic and financial. And Ellen, I'm just in awe that you come up with one terrific topic after another, and you provide such important insights into the articles that you write. I remember how struck I was when I read Web of Debt, and it was recommended to me by a friend, and I got the book, and it was big, and I was involved. I had begun writing at that time, so I was involved in the other things that I was doing, and I didn't jump onto the book immediately, but I didn't waste too much time, and I started reading. I at least wanted to read some of it. And once I started, I absolutely couldn't stop. I just had to keep reading that book. I mean, you just drew me into it like a serial that you need to find out what are you going to talk about next? What's the next topic taking me through this important story on money power and the history of it and what works so well and what doesn't work well? And really, and the things that we can do that literally can change a system that causes so much harm to people in most countries. There are a few countries that get out from under this horror system. Very, very few. Some do a better job than others, but the majority of people in the world are grievously harmed by this system. And I guess Greece, of course, makes the news, so it's a poster child. And it looks like there'll be another election there, Ellen. The so-called left of center parties, you know, you can't go by the names of the parties because the two dominant ones, one of them is called the Socialist Party, just like the Socialist Party of France, and neither one of them has a socialist bone in their bodies. They deplore socialism. You know, well, you know, the kind of socialism they support, Ellen, socialism for the rich and free market capitalism for everybody else. That's a marvelous system for the rich folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll just say about my, you said you couldn't put it down. You know, I'm actually a writer. I mean, my first degree was in English. I always wanted to be a writer, and I've spent a lot of time studying novels and trying to figure out how they set up the plot so that you want to keep reading, you know, how to make it a page turner. And so one reviewer said that my book read like a Tom Clancy novel, only this one was true. That was my favorite review, because that was what I was trying to do. I was trying to make it so that you would want to just keep reading. And that's what I'm now writing on, public banking. And it's a little harder. First of all, I had 6 years to do Web of Debt. And so this one, I'm kind of trying to rush it out because I really want to get this information out there. But it's a little harder to set up my plot in the same way. But it's just one layer of intrigue after another. I mean, it's unbelievable the things that we haven't been told. So now I'm getting into the whole, the same thing that happened in the colonies happened in Australia, where they set up the Commonwealth Bank of Australia as a public bank that just, it was just like the bank in Philadelphia, only much more sophisticated. It was a real bank, you know, with depositors and stuff. But And it worked brilliantly well. They funded World War One and seaways and roadways and all sorts of things just by issuing the credit of the nation. But just like Benjamin Franklin made the mistake of going to London and saying how well the system worked and how it had made the colonists independent and all that, and that you know, they needed the system, and the Bank of England was alarmed and leaned on the king to not allow us to do that anymore, because the idea was not to have colonies that broke free. The point of having colonies was so they would be dependent on you and feed you with the raw materials and be dependent on you financially. So that was the same thing with all the British colonies that had broken, that had gotten independence. They were still supposed to be reliant on the Bank of England financially. That's where they got their money. So when the head of the Commonwealth Bank of Australia then in 1923 went to London and boasted about how well they had come through World War One, they didn't need help from anybody and they had funded it all just with the credit of the nation, and that they could fund anything that Australians could imagine was within their reach because they had the credit power of the nation behind them. And this totally alarmed the Bank of England once again, and he died suddenly and rather at an early age of a heart attack. And so then, I mean, I doubt there was any intrigue there, but it did happen. Maybe there was intrigue. The Bank of England imposed a committee, and they got this bright idea that they would set up central banks everywhere. First they did it in Australia, and that worked so well that they thought they'd do it everywhere, where the central bank would have the power to issue the money. So they took the power to issue money away from the Treasury, which was the government, and gave it to the central bank, which would be under the control of the Bank of England in a sort of pyramid arrangement. So all the central banks would be under the Bank of England, and the central bank would decide how much money would be issued and then lent to the government, and then they could control the quantity by this goal of stability, which meant you can't issue your own money and you can't borrow from your own central bank, basically. So then the man that came from the governor, that it was Otto Niemeyer, came from England, from the Bank of England to Australia, and then he also went to New Zealand and set up the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, and then he became head of the Bank for International Settlements. So obviously, and you know, we know now that the Bank of Bank of International Settlements is the head of this whole scheme where they set the rates, they set the rules, and they, I mean, they broke the Japanese bank with Basel I, they broke the our banks with Basel II, they're breaking the local community banks and the public banks with Basel III, with this whole idea that of stability, that stability of the money supply, meaning you can't expand the money supply, which means your government can't issue its own money, and you can't borrow from a central bank that just issues the money, as if borrowing privately doesn't increase the money supply. But we know that borrowing privately increases the money supply just the same as if you were borrowing from your own public bank, except the difference is you have to pay interest, which means it increases the money supply even more because somebody else has to go into debt to create the interest. So it's all, you know, it's just this huge, there's intrigue everywhere. And I haven't even gotten into Libya. I didn't know whether I wanted to go there or not, but maybe I'll save that for another book, because there's the whole, another whole level of intrigue when you start talking about oil and, you know, that whole war
scene. Well, I wrote plenty about Libya, and Clarity Press has a book on Libya that I think will be coming out before too very long. And one of the contributors to it, Cynthia McKinney, is the editor of the book and a contributor, and a number of others. I think everybody contributing is someone I know. And I was asked to contribute as well. Last year I wrote volumes on Libya, and I quoted you in at least one of my articles when you talked about how the money system changed the state-controlled Tripoli Bank, public money, shifted to Benghazi, and HSBC, I think, took it over.
Mm-hmm.
Public money became HSBC, I guess, running as a sort of de facto Federal Reserve, Libyan style, you know, imperial style. And, of course, people lost everything, and there were many reasons Gaddafi was targeted. I mean, a lot of them was because he was doing the right thing. That's very bad to go up against Washington doing the right thing when Washington wants you to do the right thing for Washington. And the
question. Well, and I think he flaunted it. That was the trouble. I mean, if he'd kept quiet, he might have gotten away with it. I know another country that gets away with it, but they don't want to talk about it, so I can't talk about it.
Well, what country are you talking about?
I can't tell you. I'll tell you later.
Okay.
No, I just, it was where a place I went, and I was suspecting that why they were getting along so well when their neighbors weren't. I said, so let me guess, you're printing the money, right? They said yes, and I said, oh, cool, can I write about it? And they said, no, we'd rather you didn't.
I can't imagine that any country is doing anything and Washington doesn't know about it. I mean, they have their people all over the world. I mean, CIA is literally everywhere. Can't imagine any place where the CIA doesn't exist. You know, some places more important than others, but, you know, even these tiny Pacific islands, you know, I mean, Washington doesn't want anybody to get away. The terrible problem of a good example. The threat of a good example. Washington is terrified about the threat of a good example.
Mm-hmm.
Other people might get the same idea. Well,
exactly.
There have been some good examples. Cuba is one. I mean, Cuba isn't beholden to the corporate money system, and Venezuela has a different system. It's not the one. It's not ideal from our point of view, Ellen. But it's far different than the Federal Reserve system, and the government of Venezuela has a lot of power over how the country is run. China, I guess you'd call them a quasi public private system. Is that an accurate description?
Well, their banks are definitely publicly held. So, I mean, they're big banks. Yeah, they have a few private banks, but they can't make inroads. They're not letting them get any kind of power. But what I love is the Bank of North Dakota, because they've been around since 1919. That was another example where they kept a low profile. Nobody ever heard of them until just recently, and probably because we started writing about them. And they've demonstrated the model very quietly. I mean, every other state is heavily in debt, and they have a budget surplus, and they're they have the lowest unemployment rate in the country, the lowest default rate on loans. They do this cooperative banking situation where the public banks actually serve the public. They're actually there to help, and they cooperate with the local banks. So even the local banks are not threatened. The local banks are helped by this arrangement. It's the local banks that deal with the customers, and then the Bank of North Dakota helps them out with their capital and liquidity requirements and expands their potential for making loans.
You know, it's an
excellent model that was kept very quiet until it came to full bloom, and then now there's nothing. I mean, there's no way they can take it down. They can't say, well, this is...
Well, after nearly a century, it would be pretty tough to challenge one little state. But at the same time, it's quite amazing that North Dakota stayed out of the maw of the Federal Reserve, and they profited so well by it. Of course, the prosperity of the state gets no publicity in the scoundrel media. They wouldn't dare talk about how well North Dakota is doing. And I remember
they say it's due to oil, but I have
it's due to oil. They could always come up with a reason to say anything. And in 2008, during the economic storm, well, of course, it's raged ever since, but in 2008, North Dakota had the largest budget surplus in its history. I mean, they did so well. Other countries were raising taxes and cutting payrolls and really causing great harm to their residents. Mm-hmm. And North Dakota gave their residents a rebate.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should all move to North Dakota.
Well, except for the weather, yep.
Except for the weather, and I guess they could start a building boom to accommodate everybody who wants to come. I mean, they absolutely have a different system than exists anyplace else. And I haven't checked the homeless situation in North Dakota. You'll find poor people everywhere. You'll find people in distress, but the condition in North Dakota is so vastly different than the rest of the country. It's literally an oasis. Why can't every state be like North Dakota? And, of course, as you've written, and I've written a little bit about it, you've written a lot more than I have, that there are initiatives in state legislatures exploring the idea of a public state bank. I want to see one of these states actually set one up, put one in business, get one going, and, you know, it could be a game changer if it was a big state. Oh, my God, I could only dream if a California ever did this, a New York, an Illinois, where I live. That would be, if not a game changer, it would be an earth mover.
Mm-hmm. Laura Wells ran for Green Party governor last governor election.
And, in California?
Yeah, and she's my good friend, and so she wants to run for controller, and she wants me to run for treasurer. But just think, I mean, it's the treasurer that controls the money. We could have our public bank if we just. In California brought a second. We brought a bill last fall that passed both houses of the legislature, and then the governor didn't sign it. It was a bill for a study to study the feasibility of a state-owned bank. And the governor didn't sign it because he said, well, we don't need another study. We can do this in-house. But, of course, will they? That's a question. So then the same man that brought it, Ben Hueso of San Diego, brought another bill just recently, and it was actually for a bank, not for a study. But it was clear that it wasn't going to get out of committee, so he withdrew it for the time being. But in each case, it was the treasurer who said it was a bad idea. And it was the treasurer in Washington State who said it was a bad idea, and that's what killed the bill there. The treasurer, first of all, the treasurers are threatened, you know, because they think that they're going to be out of a job. All the money's going to go into this bank instead of going into the treasurer. I mean, I don't know that was the real motivation of our treasurer. The way it's set up right now, all the revenues go to the treasurer, who then puts everything left. He keeps, like in California, he keeps $2 billion in a transaction account for the immediate business of the government, and all the rest goes into this treasurer's investment pool. There's $70 billion in there. And it doesn't seem to change. It's just money that's just sitting there. And it's currently earning 0.49% interest. In other words, it's earning almost nothing. And meanwhile, the state is borrowing at 5% interest. So that money goes to Wall Street, and Wall Street lends it back to us. Now, in North Dakota, that money goes directly into the Bank of North Dakota. And the bank then turns a nice profit. So that money is making the 5% that Wall Street would be making off it. So if nothing else, we're just giving away 5% of $70 billion right off the top. That we could be using that for that would be enough right there to fund the state deficit. We wouldn't be in hock, and I mean, we wouldn't be in the hole anymore. Like they've slashed services everywhere. I mean, it's just horrible what's happened to the schools. The schools are all run down. They don't have any money to fix anything, and of course they've laid off all kinds of teachers. And even with all those cuts, we still aren't able to balance the budget. So anyway, it seems if you understood what we're talking about here, it's a no-brainer. Of course we should have our own bank instead of giving it away somewhere else. But if you were the treasurer yourself and you could see that and you set it up that way, it'd be a done deal.
It should be a done deal. It really should be a done deal. I get so incensed, Ellen, at what I see going on with no end in sight. I point blank, bluntly state, we have a dysfunctional, corrupted system. The political element is in the pocket of the big moneyed interests at the federal, state, and local level. On a local basis, Chicago is just as bad is what goes on in Washington. You know, the dollar signs aren't quite as big, but Chicago is not exactly a small town. And it is, I mean, it literally is a town that is built for business interests at the expense of ordinary people, and they're harmed so grievously. I wrote in the last few days or so what Obama did to harm black people so much when he was a state senator in Illinois, in the district of the state that he represented. He literally booted black people out so the big real estate moneyed interest could come in and gentrify the area and make a fortune on the backs of poor black people that got the boot to nowhere. You know, public housing they lost on their own to find their own. That was Obama back as a state senator. Nothing changed as a president. And it's the same. Republicans, Democrats, the system is corrupted. The system is broken. Big money is tied to big Washington, to big Illinois, to big California, big Chicago, Los Angeles, and so on. And we literally have to change this. And the only solution I really see that's possible, Ellen, is people getting incurring so much pain that they simply reach a level where they cross a threshold of no return and they won't take it anymore. The strong street protests in Europe, much, much stronger than anything in America, I expect them to get stronger still. I expect them in America to get stronger. And the only solution for me is we have to tear this system down to the ground and start over again and build the one that we know works. It can be done. When you have, there's a name for that. It's called revolution. And when you get one, and there's certainly been a lot of them in world history, and there'll be more coming, hopefully producing the right results. But when you have a revolution, you never know how they'll turn out. And all too often, they produce the wrong, not the right results. So that's the risk. But things are getting worse and worse now, and I see what's happening around me. I literally can see the future of America, and it's too black. It's black enough to make me say, I'm glad I'm not young anymore. I don't want to live in a country like this. I don't want to grow up in a country like this. I had opportunity growing up. Young people today have none, unless you come from a well-off family. Oh, Ellen, finish up with a final comment. I ran the clock. I didn't mean to do that.
I agree, but for some reason I still feel optimistic. I think we can turn it around.
But it'll take people power to do
it. It has to fall apart.
We agree. It takes people power to do it.
Things have to get bad before they can get better.
Oh, absolutely. It's always darkest before the dawn.
Right, right.
Maybe we should hope for pitch darkness, and then maybe daylight won't be too far from then. Ellen, I look forward to next month to getting you back. I will send you an email. We'll firm up the next time on the program, and I always look forward to it. And all of your articles, and listeners can go to Web of Debt, follow them all, and also on many websites. Oh, loads of them published for you, Ellen. My goodness, we could spend the next half hour naming them all. And on every website, ought to post your articles. They really are very special. I encourage listeners to read them all and follow them. You will get an education. Ellen, till next month.
Thanks.
And I'll just remind my listeners, every Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, make it a regular habit.